Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, Kyle Hopkins of the Anchorage Daily News, and Mark Trahant, who's Atwood Professor of Journalism at UAA here in Anchorage. Tim, legislation that would provide for state participation in a multi-billion dollar gas line is moving forward, but there are many, many questions still. Give us the latest synopsis of this changing scene.
Michael, this is a big deal, and it's a very complicated deal. Basically, where it is right now, there is a bill in the legislature, both the House and the Senate, but the Senate bill is the one that's moving, that essentially gives the administration permission to go negotiate the deal. It's permissive. The next step will come next year when if the bill passes, they'll come back with a big package as to how we'd actually do this thing, you know, why we'd participate, how much money it would cost. And more particularly, some of the sensitive items in the bill are, what are the fiscal terms in it? The oil companies say what we have to do is to establish our fiscal terms, tax terms and royalty, not change them. Well, how's that going to work? And all that's, details yet to come.
And a delegation of mayors just appeared before the legislature concerned about some of these tax questions as applies to them.
Well, that's true, because if you read the so-called heads of agreement, which is the foundation document between the state and the companies, which is the starting point for this thing, it refers to fiscal terms, it refers to municipal taxes, how it would affect municipal tax base. And what the mayors are concerned about, Mike Navarre from Kenai, the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the North Slope Borough, and Denali Borough are all concerned about limitations that this would put on their ability to tax their own properties within their borough, including existing properties. So there's some concern about it. What the mayors want is they want some instructions or some sideboards in the bill that would give the administration guidance as to how to protect their interests.
And what's getting legislators' attention? What is the top of their concerns?
Well, one concern is really besides, you know, what are we starting here? You know, what kind of a slippery slope are we on? Is how much money is this going to cost? I mean, where is the state going to get the money to invest in this? By that time, our resources might be fairly depleted. What are our benefits? And you know, it turns out the consultants are telling them that this could be worth several billion dollars a year to us in terms of new revenues.
And we'd have to invest how much, or is that still a wide range?
It depends on whether we bring in partners. We're already looking at the concept of partnering with TransCanada, a pipeline company, on part of the pipeline. We might bring in some other partners that would reduce the amount of equity we'd put in, but it would be several billion dollars we'd have to put into it. But the gain would be earning $4 to $5 billion a year starting when the gas pipeline starts up.
Okay, let's leave it there. Kyle, you and photographer Mark Lester did a remarkable series on fetal alcohol syndrome and the impact it has on individual lives and Alaskan communities and families as well. Give us the overview, what it is, how common it is, and what are the consequences, and then we're going to look at some video.
The series, kind of within a series that we're working on right now, is about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, which includes fetal alcohol syndrome, which is the most visible and easily diagnosed of these disabilities that are caused and only caused by a mother drinking while pregnant. And while no one knows exactly what the rates are state by state, we think in Alaska that we probably have the highest rate or one of the highest rates. We also make some of the most effort to diagnose children, but there's a lot of room for improvement there, and that's what some of the future stories will look at. But the first two stories we focused solely on, the first story that we wrote, we just wanted to kind of introduce people to some of the mothers, the birth mothers who have had these children, and tell their stories a little bit and kind of explain the many, many ways that it can happen. And also just the science of what's happening in the womb, which is striking. I mean, there are things I thought I understood a little bit about these disabilities, but very quickly you learn that the disability, the damage can happen very early in the pregnancy, before the mother probably is going to know that she's pregnant.
In other words, some members of the public may have the idea that a diagnosed woman who's been told she's pregnant is out drinking, when that may not be the case at all.
Right, and I think if you ask most pregnant mothers, when they stop drinking, they'll say, well, I stopped drinking as soon as I knew I was pregnant. Well, when did you find out you were pregnant? Because you can do serious, the damage that causes fetal alcohol syndrome specifically, that kind of reforms a child's face, that happens about 3 weeks into a pregnancy, and most people are not going to know they're pregnant at that point, especially if they're not expecting to get pregnant. And half of women who get pregnant in Alaska weren't intending to get pregnant. So when you think of it that way, wow, it can happen to almost anybody who's drinking. And this first video clip is a mother who lives here in town, who is talking about getting her diagnosis for her daughter. Her daughter had very extreme behavioral problems, and she knew that there was something wrong. And she also was fairly upfront with her doctors about the fact that she drank while pregnant. And so she's talking about kind of awaiting the diagnosis and whether or not she wanted it.
Let's take a look at that video.
I remember the days before I kind of went back and forth on, was I praying for a diagnosis or not? And I had mixed feelings, because if she had the diagnosis, well, then, you know, that means that it's my fault. You know, I did this to her. But if she didn't get the diagnosis, then it's kind of like, well, what is wrong with her then? This can't all be me.
Kyle, let's go back to you.
And so she's talking about awaiting the diagnosis. And what that means is that there were four or five professionals, each who were interviewing her daughter, a psychologist, an occupational therapist, which means kind of like a physical therapist, a nurse. And they're all a speech therapist, and they're all spending hours with this child, and they're also taking pictures of her face and then using a facial recognition software to just see if she has these characteristics that are common with fetal alcohol syndrome. And so it's a long process. It costs thousands of dollars. Most children, and certainly most adults in Alaska who have fetal alcohol syndrome, or especially another version of that disability, which can be just as severe, but there's no evidence on your face. Most people are never going to be diagnosed. In this case, her daughter, Serenity, was diagnosed. And the next clip is the mother talking about her reaction to that, the conclusion of that diagnosis.
Okay, let's hear what she has to say.
When I went into the meeting, we discussed it all. I didn't react the way I expected to. You know, I didn't react with that feeling of guilt like I thought I would. It was kind of more a feeling of relief, because it was like, I'm not losing my mind. I think I dealt with the guilt long before. I think I dealt with the guilt when I was first getting clean and first trying to turn my life around. I don't have time to feel guilty, because if I take time to feel guilty, then you know what? I'm taking time away from my kids. She is the way she is because of me, yes. Is there guilt? Yeah, there is. I did what I did. I can't change that. But what I can do is fight like hell to get her what she needs. And that's my goal in life. My goal in life is to give her the best life that she can have.
Kyle?
And that video was shot by Mark Lester, and it's one of four mothers, and she's one of four mothers that we profiled in the first and in the second story, because in the second story we introduce the children and talk a little bit about their symptoms, which can, with each child, it can be different. And that's the trick with FASD, and the reason that we forget that it's as big a problem as it is, because 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 11 people who have this disability do not have any facial characteristics, and so they're more likely to never be diagnosed. And yet they have these behavioral problems that are no fault of their own. They were born with them. I mean, they're truly innocent. They were born with sometimes the inability to truly understand cause and effect of their actions. They might be more impulsive. They might have learning disabilities. And yet when they're sitting in a classroom, no one would know that. And so you can have a child like Serenity, who we just saw in the video, who she's a smart child. She does well in school. She has a high IQ. And yet there are behavioral problems which doctors would attribute to her prenatal alcohol exposure, you know, like impulse control. She just put a caregiver put her arm in a sling for 4 days during a kind of an outburst, which is not uncommon to have these kind of meltdowns or tantrums for some of some of, but certainly not all of the children. And so when you pull the camera back and think, okay, so if, even if just 1% of Alaska has this disability, and the number's probably higher than that, given that we're more likely to have a higher rate than other states, then it starts to connect to these other big problems that we have in our state. It makes you wonder about our suicide rate, and it makes you wonder about our sexual assault rate, given that
incarceration
in our you know, and the cost of keeping people in prison, and especially keeping people in prison who literally can't learn from their mistakes in the same way that someone who was born without the disability could, or would from day to day kind of remember a lesson learned. You know, their memory problems. So we feel like it's a major issue in Alaska, and we have several more stories that we'll be writing on the topic.
Okay, and when the time comes, we'll take them up here on Alaska Edition. Mark, after a lengthy and distinguished career in Northwest journalism, you have come here as the Atwood Professor of Journalism at UAA. Tell us some of the first things about Alaska public life and public policy that caught your attention when you arrived here. I guess this is the compare and contrast test.
Okay. Well, just the discussion we were having earlier about the pipeline. I live in Idaho, and in Idaho, legislators would not be keen on any government involvement with any kind of investment. It philosophically, in fact, there was a plan to have a open air or an open trade zone, and that was seen as too much government involvement in private affairs for Idaho. So there's a different brand of conservatism that it's been interesting to watch.
Okay, and demographics too. I mean, tell us about that.
Well, demographics is something that I've spent a lot of time on. This is, you think about the arc of history, and so much of history is stuff that we've dealt with before in just different forms, and it's history may not repeat, but it rhymes. Demographics is something absolutely new, never before faced. We're the first generation where, in the United States, more than 10,000 people a day are turning 65, and it's a much smaller young population. And coupled on top of that, a child born today has a 50-50 chance of being 100. And so you're living longer, you're having this huge population of older people and a much smaller population of young people, and that creates a tension that is unique to history.
And to some degree, we have examples of what can happen in several of the European countries and Japan, correct?
Right. They're ahead of us in this trend. In fact, the United States is in much better shape in that sense. But we're just, it's a trend that we're following. In fact, almost the entire world is doing it, except for Africa and parts of Asia.
You told me you were working on a book about scarcity. In this context, how would you define that, and what have been some of your areas of interest?
Well, you think about scarcity in the sense that what's going to be required to support an older population versus a younger population, and how are we going to determine resources? For example, this younger population now that's much smaller than previous generations is the first generation that carries more debt into the workforce than all of credit cards combined. And so we're starting them off trying to support an older generation buried in debt.
And then we hear all these stories about young people living at home, being highly educated and having to put those to limited opportunities, that sort of thing as well, right?
Right. I mean, just the challenges of how do you buy a car and buy a house, all the things that previous generations have done when you're carrying student loans that are
And all those
month.
Things, those kind of purchases are major contributions to our economy as American and Alaskans, right?
Right. And they're already smaller. I mean, you start from a point where it's a smaller base.
Okay. Tim, Flint Hills, the refinery, and the company owns the refinery in Fairbanks. Governor Parnell absolves a future buyer of the troubled North Pole refinery from liability they might incur as a result of the chemical spills cleanup that would take place up there. The spill's already taken place, but the cleanup is to come. Soon after that, Governor Parnell sued the current and previous owners of the refinery. There's a lot going on here at the Fairbanks refinery, and there's some pretty strong talk here, and strong positions have been taken by both the governor and the owners.
Michael, it's a real mess, literally. The Flint Hills announced just a few weeks ago that they're going to shut down this summer. They're a major supplier. They are the major supplier of gasoline and a big supplier of heating oil in Fairbanks. So if it's not made there, oil course, comes from the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to be refined, it's going to have to be shipped in. And that's something that's the whole reason the refinery was built back in the 1970s, was to give Fairbanks, you know, the interior more self-sufficiency in fuel. But over the years, the refinery's had a lot of commercial challenges. It made a lot of its money selling jet fuel to Anchorage, but the airlines coming into Anchorage have started importing jet fuel from overseas, which is cheaper. So that cut into a lot of the refinery's margins and has hurt them commercially. So one thing led to another, and then recently they've gotten a real problem with a leak of a chemical they use in making gasoline, which is accumulated under the refinery property. It was actually occurred under the previous owner, Williams Companies, but the leak has spread beyond the refinery. It's contaminating water wells, the residents. Flint Hills has stepped up to the plate, providing bottled water to like 300 local homeowners, which is a big deal. It's costing them $2 million a year. But now with the refinery, the company would like to sell the property. There's apparently a new company interested in maybe trying to come in and operate the refinery. But with this liability, it feels it can't sell. So it's pointing the finger at Williams, saying, you share some of this liability. Williams said, oh no, we had a contract, you accepted it all. By the way, the state owned the land before, the state owns part of the liability. So there's a big lot of finger pointing. The lawsuit, the company is asking the state to step in and indemnify the company. The governor is not quite willing to go that far yet. The lawsuit was filed just to get a court to weigh into this and who has the liability.
So well, that's kind of the politics of this would be for governor running for re-election in an election year, it'd be very hard to give Koch brothers, Flint Hills, what they want. I mean, the politics of this seem to be totally on the side that Parnell took.
You'd think. Another nuance to this is the stuff is very difficult to clean up. It's in the water table, moving around. How would you clean it up? Big technical challenges. And there's a big, strong disagreement between the company and the state over the standard of contamination that would be left. The DEC has set a very low standard, or rather very high standard, that the soil and the water would have to be clean. The company disagrees with that. So there's a lot of scientific disputes that are involved also.
And I assume that a lawsuit of this kind could take years before it's either settled, let alone gets to court, and then there are all the potential appeals that are out there for this kind of suit.
And you know, if the refinery goes away, the Fairbanks will be, there is a second small refinery there that could take up some of the slack, but that's going to make the interior is going to have to get their fuel from Anchorage.
And do we have any hint here of what the federal government in the form of the EPA, at least that agency, might be thinking about this?
Well, I'm told the EPA is watching this very carefully. They have authority also, but in cases like this, it's primarily the state DEC that's on the front line. And if the state is able to work out some agreement for sharing liability, and the company would have to come up with a cleanup plan, EPA would probably go along. But EPA could also step in and assert some jurisdiction also.
And then, of course, there's also the question of who the jurisdiction would be over because of these different owners.
That's right.
Mark, you told me that your home state, Idaho, is really three states. Explain that to us, and does that in any way play out up here?
Well, they joke in Idaho it's the only state with three capitals, Boise, Spokane, and Salt Lake City. Different parts of the state have tremendous influence from different regions, and the economic capitals are so. One of the trends that I think is really interesting that does impact Alaska is the growing importance of cities to an economy. And here the connection with Seattle. You see, and I'm a former Seattle person as well, and you see it all the time, and how that relationship works out.
Does Alaska look like more than one state to you?
Absolutely. I think it's been described as another country, and I think that fits pretty well, too.
And in the legislature in your home state, who goes down to the legislature or who calls up the legislature and always gets their phone calls returned? I'm not talking about by name here, but the kind of industries or businesses or civic entities.
The great state of Idaho just made it illegal to do any kind of investigative work involving dairies, so I think that tells you a lot. That it's now a crime to videotape cows in any kind of sick capacity.
And one of the things you told me that I think we can amuse our viewers here a little bit with is, who is the highest paid public official in the state of Idaho?
Right. I saw this list of the highest paid officials in different states, and I was struck by how educators are on the list in Alaska. In Idaho, it's the football coach.
at Boise State.
Boise State.
Do you remember what he was getting paid?
It had a lot of zeros. I remember that.
And finally, just a question about government. Obviously, you're here as a consumer of the government, mostly from television and radio. I don't know if you've gone down there and watched our government. The legislature there, how often do they meet and for how long?
The Idaho legislature meets every year, and they have this zest to get done on time, and they tend to do it. They have a set day of 45 days, and they get out of there. It's something they're very proud of.
And given your background and your experience and your reporting experience, too, what really strikes you, and I realize this is kind of putting you at a serious disadvantage, but in a couple minutes, of the difference between Native affairs in your home state as you've observed them in here, what really stands out to a visitor?
Oh, there's a long difference in history. The biggest difference is that in Idaho, tribes are both governments and corporations. Here, they're corporations, and the role of government hasn't been figured out. It's an open question. I think that's going to be an interesting question for the next decade.
And do you know off the top of your head how many enrolled members they have there and who live in Idaho?
It'd be much smaller. There are five tribes in Idaho, and the Shoshone-Bannock tribe, which I'm a member of, is the largest with about 5,000.
And how much land do they have under their control at the present time?
Probably 2 million acres for the state, so it's a much smaller percentage.
And
as
this
well.
Essentially is a part of the process of Western conquest, right?
Right. And in the difference is when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed, is in the lower 48, most of the tribes reserve lands, and they took everything except what was actually reserved. And here with the land settlement, it has just a different history.
And you've told me you've written about the Native Claims Act, right?
I have.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Have a book called The Last Great Battle of the Indian Wars, and it tells the story of the Indian Self-Determination Act. But leading up to that was the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the role of Henry Jackson, the senator from Washington, who was a longtime chair of the Interior Committee. And back then, the chair of the Interior Committee was pretty close to an absolute authority on any Western issue. And Jackson's role was interesting. And I also talk about Richard Nixon and his role. One of the stories that I think is remarkable is there was a meeting with John Ehrlichman at the White House, and they were talking about ANCSA.
Who's his domestic advisor, for those
John
who don't
Ehrlichman
remember,
is yeah. a domestic advisor and a lawyer from Seattle. And Ehrlichman professed that he had just talked to Nixon, and Nixon wanted $1 billion and 43 million acres or whatever the number was. And everyone was astonished. It changed the discussion, and later, Leonard Garment, whom I interviewed, said, did you really talk to Nixon? And he just smiled.
And Leonard Garment he had many roles in Washington, D.C., as a lawyer in
right.
particular, but he was counsel to the president at that
he
time?
John Dean was counsel at that point. He was an assistant to John Ehrlichman, but he later became counsel to the president.
Okay.
And also a jazz musician. And
bon vivant and man about town.
Right.
Okay. Tim, Governor Parnell has endorsed and taken up and then very interested in an ambitious road program, which would include a road to the Ambler Mining District in Northwest Alaska. Now, men and women our age have heard roads to somewhere in distant Alaska for a long, long time. What does the governor have in mind here, and what are his prospects?
Well, this is called the Roads to Resources Program, Michael, and its idea has been around for a number of years, but the idea is the state would help support and plan roads out to strategic areas where there might be resource development. And the one that appears to be farthest along is this road from the Dalton Highway about 200 miles west to the Ambler Mining District, where a couple of mining companies, mainly Nova Copper and in partnership with NANA Regional Corporation, are developing copper prospects or exploring copper prospects. Now, what's significant about this, though, is that the and it shows how these things sort of evolve. The state DOT started it as a traditional highway, did some early planning, turned it over to ADA, which is the Industrial Development Authority, and which is now supervising the project. The interesting thing about this is that ADA will not do a road unless there's a customer that agrees to pay for the road. So this is not going to be a traditional state public highway.
And talking about paying for the road, how much money are they thinking of per mile here, and how many miles?
You know, I don't recall the figures, Michael, but it's the road itself would cost a couple hundred million dollars, something in that range, maybe a bit more. The mining company would pay for it by tolls, moving the ore over the road. Very similar, by the way, to the way the Red Dog Road is paid for. It was built also by Ada to reach the Red Dog Mine in the late 1980s, and it's been very successful.
And if some member of the public decided, I want to drive up there from Fairbanks, would they be able to do that?
Well, that's a catch. As an Ada project, the people who live in the villages up there are very sensitive to access, public access. They don't want
new moose hunters.
Yeah, people coming in outside the region. So as an ADA-controlled road, the thinking is they would have a much better chance of controlling access as a quasi-private road than would be the case as a public road. The Dalton Highway, for example, this was a battle fought.
Right.
The Dalton Highway had state money in it, so it became a public road.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it right there. We're out of time. Thank you for joining us on Alaska Edition. See you next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.